AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair. And welcome to Noia House in Hollywood, where we are hosting our first ever live episode. This is very exciting.
I'm delighted to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And with David Canfield.
Hi, Katie.
How are we doing, you guys?
Well, this is how we record every week.
I think the thing
that people need to know,
I know,
is that we're always in Los Angeles, where we all live.
In this hotel, actually.
This is not a hotel. This is
it's a cultural center.
Oh, this is where you don't know I live.
But it's a cultural center where I live, and you guys every week come, and we record together. It's great.
We're really excited to be here. As we mentioned, we're going to be joined later with Lily Gladstone, the star of Killers of the Flower Moon, as well as Jacqueline West, the costume designer, and Julie O'Keefe, the consultant. But first, we have an award season that's going on. You guys might have heard about it. If you're here in this room, you probably know that as we're talking on Tuesday, Oscar voting ends in a few hours. So if you have a ballot and you're an Oscar voter, get it submitted. Hope you're not here if you haven't put it in yet. So we're going to talk about award season and what's been going on and the award shows that we've been kind of inundated with over the past week or so. I've never seen so many televised award shows in such a short period.
It's funny to have the Emmys kind of dive bomb in. It's like, we're talking about movies right now, Emmys. And they're like, no. We give us Monday, please.
Yep, exactly. They had Monday. So we're going to start with the Critics' Choice Awards, which were on Sunday. David, you and I were there together in person at the May December table, which was a delight. I mean, David, you've been at all of these events kind of nonstop. Your wardrobe budget is just ballooning. But what stood out to you about being at that event specifically? What kind of made that distinctive?
Well, I got to sit at a table with Julianne Moore and Charles Melton, so that stood out a little bit.
Yeah.
Two hideous people.
Yes.
and they were having a terrible time together, obviously.
I kind of had to be like, oh my God. Yes, I did take Monday off as well for the Emmys because it's been a lot. I think the main thing that stood out in terms of the show was the fact that the attendance was so strong. Mm-hmm. I mean, normally the Critics' Choice Awards are a little bit less fully attended among Oscar nominees, especially when it's such a starry year. But the fact is that because of the way the calendar shook out, especially with the SAG strike, you had all these shows occurring during voting or just before voting, which means maximum time for visibility. So you would see DiCaprio, Bradley Cooper, every name, Ryan Gosling, a very famous Ryan Gosling reaction shot already. They were all there in the room. And so that meant when people won, you had a lot of big names watching them win, which of course only adds to the resonance in a few tight races especially.
Yeah, and you had been at the Academy Governors Awards a few days before and in your report kind of talking about like all of these luminaries in the room supporting each other. And then I was kind of watching it happen in real time where someone goes up and you see Bradley Cooper immediately stand up for a standing ovation and Emma Stone right there. Like the support felt so visible, which is something I don't think I would have known had I not seen it in person.
Katie doesn't get to go to these things as often, so I enjoyed watching her sort of observe the way the gravity of a room shifts when a Bradley Cooper gets up.
Yeah.
And everyone sort of slowly drifts toward them. That's where award season happens. That's where you really notice who is kind of owning the narrative of the year. And whether or not Bradley Cooper ends up winning, it doesn't seem to be going in that direction. He's been a major story of the season, and that's where you see something like that.
Yeah. I mean, Richard, you watched it not live in the room.
No.
But
he watches the CW every Sunday night.
Well, I'm a stakeholder in the CW, yes. So I ran all the DC shows. I was The Flash and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, you're very, very wealthy as a result. But what did you notice?
I don't know why I'm here. I'm so rich. I don't know why I'm here.
What did you notice from what you saw from the Critics' Choice Awards?
Well, I mean, not to turn to the negative, but the Golden Globes were such a catastrophe.
Oh, we're going
to
get there. Don't worry. We're getting there.
Where I was watching, it was the first award show in, I've been at Vanity Fair 10 years, and every year since then, I've been like, no, I have to cover these awards. I cannot watch with other people. I have to be alone at home, hermetic. And for whatever reason, the Golden Globes this year was the first time I like accepted an invite to go to a watch party, and I brought my laptop, so I was like, so I could write.
Yeah.
And then it was like that. It was like Joe Coy, and I was like, this is like the craziest. I need to like leave immediately and just like
report
write
to the
about
war rooms, emergency.
So that was a bad precedent setting for the January award show. And then like I thought the Critics' Choice, like Chelsea Handler, who used to date Joe Coy, and made a joke sort of about him, I thought she did a good, solid, competent job, and you know, made fun of the movies, but also celebrated the movies. And then the winners were kind of actually in line with, I think, where we're sort of thinking that the Oscars could go.
Yeah.
So it felt like a very sort of solid lily pad that this campaign could like leap off of, where the Golden Globes felt a little more chaotic, not in the winners, but the hosting kind of made that night weird.
Yeah, it did feel comfortable in a way. And even when there are like winners, you know, I think we're going to talk about the Best Actor race and how, I mean, I think David and I were sitting there being like, I don't know who's going to win this. And Julianne Moore had her predictions, which we will share, but
off the record.
Some of us were surprised.
Julianne Moore has voted a straight Super Mario Brothers ticket.
She was devastated. Yeah. Jack Black did not make the short list.
She stole my idea, unfortunately. But it felt very comfortable because it's, you know, even when there's a little bit of a surprise, like obviously everyone's really deserving. Obviously everyone's getting their standing ovations. It did feel like the car was back on the track in some ways.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the speeches were good. And and we had this interesting early part of the season where like I'm, you know, part of the New York Film Critics Circle, and we gave Charles Melton the Supporting Actor Award, and he won elsewhere for that. And then, like, but the thinking was always, like, sure, that's lovely, but, like, Robert Downey Jr. is sort of lying in wait backstage to, like, take, you know, this, and then that's what's been happening, and his speech has been good, and, you know.
Like, I mean, you know it's going to, that's the thing, is when you get someone who's, like, that big of a movie star, you kind of know what you're getting in for. Whereas David Joyner Randolph, who's been giving just endless speeches, and we expect to be, like, she comes very prepared. She's kind of introducing herself to people, and I feel like she's introducing herself as a consummate professional, which is exactly what she is. It's working really well, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's that Yale education, you know.
We do love talking about Yale when we're talking about these people. I wanted to ask about the America Ferrera speech, actually, because she didn't win a competitive award, but she got the honorary award, and I think it was about halfway through her speech where I was like, oh, voting is still happening. She is in the mix for supporting actress, but it's like, it's a competitive race. That, I mean, it went over so well in the room. Like, she did wonderfully.
You could also do worse and have Margot Robbie, who is the story of this film year in a lot of ways, introduce her, which she did. And I think that allowed everybody to really sit up straight in their seat and know this was a moment. She knocked that speech out of the park. Mm-hmm. Even the little technical glitches that happened with the teleprompter, which there were a few of those throughout the night.
Sure.
It is the CW, so what can we expect, really? That'll be my last winner.
How dare you?
Charles Melton will not be happy with me. So in that sense, you know, that race is so kind of slippery right now. You have a lot of different possibilities because you have people like Penelope Cruz, who got a SAG nomination for Ferrari. You have a couple people on this BAFTA long list who may be nominated later this week, and that has a lot of overlap with the Academy. So America Ferrera hasn't shown up at a ton of places, but she's a big face of a big contender.
Yeah.
And when she gives a speech like that, where everyone in that room, a lot of Academy members, I'm not saying the show was, you know, that widely watched, but even just the industry buzz, I think, was really strong around it.
Yeah, I think it was.
And it reminds people that she had a really big moment in that movie, a moment that has carried through, obviously, and that could take her a long way.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she has this monologue that I guess you could look at as sort of defining one ethos of the film. And like Beatrice Straight all those years ago won an Oscar for one monologue, you know, like there is precedent for it in a way that I think that like the Academy voters have a little bit extra time than all these other awards bodies did, who did not give her America Ferrera nominations. But like, I don't know. I just think that like with that sort of special moment that happened, and they're still in voting.
Yep. A few more hours left.
Yeah. A few more hours left. I don't know. I think that I guess that would be a really litmus test of like, how much the Academy loves Barbie, and I think they probably are going to like it a lot. So
yeah, well, that's the question. I feel like we've talked about this in other weeks. Like, the we've been fearing Barbie snobbery among the Academy, and I think what was telling at the Critics' Choice Awards is not just Barbie had that moment. It had another. It won for Best Comedy, but it wasn't on the air because they do that. They give out awards during commercial breaks, which is strange.
They went too fast, so they needed to fill the time, and so Chelsea right. Handler made a wonderful bit out of needing to give Barbie its moment.
Yeah,
which kind of gave away it wasn't winning Best Picture, which I had thought.
She knew that? You think she knew the results and it wasn't going to win Best
well,
Picture?
Well, I'm sure it was
she's the only critic who votes on it. Chelsea Handler is the only...
Critics' Choice stands for Chelsea.
Did you not know that?
No, she reads all that. The envelopes right before...
She also decides the Tony Awards.
So I think that she had an understanding probably through production of where the night was going.
Sure.
And also by that point, Oppenheimer had sort of started to take all the technical awards as it has done.
Yeah.
I don't know what you were going, where you're going with that.
Oh, just, I mean, thinking about the presence of Barbie and how like Chelsea Handler really went out of her way to make it even more visible than it already was, which like, you know, I'm Just Ken won, which obviously warmed my heart. That's my...
Created a meme, Ryan Gosling reacting to that.
Right? I was in the bathroom line. I missed that entire thing.
You're always in the bathroom when memes are happening.
Who was it who was in the bathroom when she won a Golden Globe?
Christine Lottie.
Thank you. Of course.
Hello. 1997, I want to say.
But no, it was like an objectively good night for Oppenheimer and winning all those awards. It wins Best Picture. Christopher Nolan got in a great... He was the original burn on the CW, actually. You guys are just following in Christopher right. Nolan's footsteps.
Right, right. Well, and Christopher Nolan directed all the episodes of Gossip Girl.
Yeah.
The original, not the Max version.
No, the original.
But it did make it feel like both of those films are very visible. But Cillian Murphy didn't win Best Actor, which is yet another twist in a race that I'm kind of obsessed with how tight it feels. And our friend Paul Giamatti loved talking about In-N-Out. He knows his moment.
He gave the best speech of the night.
You think so?
Yeah, I do. And I think that it made it very clear to me that this is a character actor who is so beloved in this industry that if he could win there over bigger movies, I think, with that group, even a maestro like it's Bradley Cooper,
sure.
I feel like SAG is a place where he is really going to pull it out. I mean, that's mm-hmm. his crowd, that's his crew. And then you figure if Cillian Murphy wins BAFTA, which I think is still very likely, you have a really, really exciting two-horse race for Best Actor, kind of in the same way that we did last year with Brendan Fraser and Austin Butler.
True.
And I don't really, who do you guys think is going to pull it out right now?
Didn't we do this last week? I made everyone say.
And then something changed.
Are you comparing Austin Butler to Paul Giamatti?
Yeah, I think they have a lot in common.
They've had the same career, basically.
You know, Austin actually turned down the holdovers, and I'm not talking about the Dominic Cecil.
Paul Giamatti was going to be Elvis. I do think that Paul Giamatti, you know, we talk on this podcast a lot about this sort of like, does a speech tour win you an award?
Yeah.
Like if you win an award early in the season and your speech is really good, are people putting you down for the winner because they want to hear you again?
Yeah.
And I don't know if they're, you know, we're all making this up, but like, I do think that like Giamatti has been really charming and also kind of not bringing so much attention to it, but kind of reminding people that like he got fucked over for Sideways. Like he did not get nominated for that.
Are we allowed to swear in
Noah
House?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we were in America.
The way we did not have an answer.
Are we not? Are we in communist Russia? No, but like, I just think his speeches have been really charming
yeah.
and like really reminding people that like, oh, this is an actor who, for whatever reason, has not gotten this kind of major, major attention in his entire, you know, almost 3-decade career. And that narrative is really compelling in a way that maybe Cillian Murphy, who also has had a long career, but he's like British. He's like been doing that stuff. Like he's not one of us. Like, you know, like, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like you think about American actors winning it. Daniel Day-Lewis, Gary Oldman. I mean, those are classic American actors.
But this was the Brendan Fraser thing last year. That was someone they knew.
But Brendan Fraser didn't win.
As you predicted.
Right? Oh, God, did he win?
Our memories just get wiped at the end of every award season, it turns out.
I don't think Richard will ever forget when he won that Oscar.
Yeah, well.
Before we get into kind of the mechanics of these award shows and the hosts and everything, I mean, David, as I was saying, you've been at endless events all the time. You have been telling me that people keep bringing up the Zone of Interest to you. And I don't even remember who it was, but we asked someone at the Critics' Choice what their favorite movie was, and they immediately said Zone of Interest. And I was like, oh, it's all happening in front of me. What else are you just... hearing about what feels like it's in the air in a way that we might not see at these award shows, but is getting that base of support?
I'm not just saying this because we have some wonderful people from the movie here, but I think Killers of the Flower Moon has had a really interesting week. It's mm-hmm. on Apple now, and it's being rediscovered in some ways. Yep. It's a movie that has stuck around since Cannes, and really any time a movie gets brought up at this point, it's worth paying attention to because yeah. Those movies that have been talked about for so long, it doesn't always last that way, even if they end up getting nominated. That's definitely one. American Fiction is a movie that I think has a lot of support, especially like in Los Angeles. Mm. There are people, I think there was a big MGM event thrown for that movie with Daniel Craig and Barbara Broccoli yep. in attendance. Do not discount the power of that.
But we should talk about Origin and before we run out of time.
I was going to say,
you didn't miss it.
We have to talk about Origin.
Can we talk about Origin?
Frances Fisher, her
Frances
power.
Frances Fisher has gotten back on the case.
Yeah. She's my new like dream.
Andrea Riseborough was like, girl, do it again.
We haven't done a roundtable interview in a long time, but if we get Frances Fisher,
really
we
should.
All need to speak
Frances
to her.
Frances Fisher is the most powerful person. For 2 months in Los Angeles, Frances Fisher is like, all right.
No, or 2 weeks, right, everybody, honestly.
Clear away.
Should we give some context?
Yes, please.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Frances Fisher is the president of Los Angeles.
Mayor, governor.
Yeah.
So Frances Fisher, of course, was an instrumental figure last year in the...
A great actor in Titanic.
Yes.
Was married to Clint Eastwood for a long time.
Industry icon, like a Los Angeles icon, especially.
And I believe Academy Board of Governors member. Yeah.
Yes, definitely in the Academy.
We yeah. No, she was higher up in the Academy.
As was Ava DuVernay, notably.
She right.
was, so she was a huge factor in the Too Leslie last-minute push last year and corralled a lot of big names in Hollywood to see the movie, to post about the movie. And that ultimately led to a shock nomination for Andrea Riseborough. And so there were some new social media guidelines put out as a result of that. A lot of controversy because of Riseborough pushing out Daniel Deadwyler, Viola Davis, notably. And so there was a question of if something like that would happen again this year, because on the one hand, it worked so shockingly for a tiny movie with a giant heart.
It sure was.
For those who know, they know. but also that was so clearly a little icky in terms of the optics of it yep. and how it
felt
it
very clubby.
Up.
Have
yes.
they not used tiny movie with a giant heart as a tagline for a Kevin Hart movie? They should. Sorry.
If you're
pocketing
listening,
that one
please.
For later. Yeah. And it came up with Origin this year. I went on Frances Fisher's Twitter on like Friday, and it was like
you pretending you don't know exactly where you went.
Tweets retweeted about Origin in a row. I mean, it became her obsession. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And there were some jokes about it, like, oh, she's at it again. And then suddenly, there's Holland Taylor, who was a big and Sarah Paulson, who were big supporters of Andrea Riseborough, posting about it. And then I saw, was it yesterday? That Angelina Jolie hosted yeah. a screening with Anjanou Ellis,
yeah.
Who is the star of the film. And I think just stepping back a little bit, Anjanou Ellis is brilliant in this.
She's so wonderful.
Good. And it is appropriate, if maybe a little cynical, that the effort is going towards a black actress who deserves to be in the conversation isn't after what happened last year. Mm-hmm. I can see how that might have played out. It makes a lot of sense. But she absolutely deserves to be a part of that conversation. And I think she can get nominated at this point. As we've learned, a very small batch of really passionate voters can get you through.
In the actors' brand specifically. That's what's so interesting
yes,
about it.
I think the idea that this little effort, and there are a lot of actors at this point who have posted about the film, who have really encouraged people to not vote for it. That's the difference, because they can't do that anymore as directly. But to see it.
To see it. Come on.
Well, wasn't that something?
Just see it.
You need to see it. You
see
need to experience this
right
movie on the big screen.
But
see
wasn't
it.
That something that Ava had talked about the idea of just trying to get visibility for the movie? Like, I feel like she'd been really frank about it. So they are answering a need that was existing that we were aware of.
Yes. And I think she's achieved that. I think yeah. now the question is, it has the visibility. It got it at the perfect time. You have a lead contender who was nominated and supporting a few years ago, who's very deserving. How far can that go?
Yeah,
she's a real industry. Anjanou Ellis has been around forever. If you guys all look under your seats, Frances Fisher is she's down there. No, I think that would be exciting. I mean, the movie is an interesting experiment, Origin. It doesn't quite work, I don't think, entirely. But, like, Anjanou Ellis is undeniably, like, this... I mean, she's narrating a lot of the movie. So you're kind of with her for 2+ hours. And it's an impactful performance, regardless of its weird experiments and the movie's weird experiments in form. And like, is it a documentary? Is it a narrative film? Whatever. And yeah, I think you're right, David. Like, that is Frances Fisher's terrible machine working towards something interesting and like good. Not that Andrea Riseborough wasn't. She was very good in her movie. But like, it it's interesting to see like the reaction to what happened last year kind of retrain its gaze onto something else. And then Frances Fisher in that kind of accidental thing and her cohort realizing like, oh, wait, I have power here. So let me kind of redirect that power into a different direction, which is kind of, in a weird way, the narrative of a lot of Hollywood. It's like, okay, yep. So we have this ability to highlight people, to rep, to mm-hmm. whatever. Let's figure out how to like put that power to use in a productive way.
Yeah. Do you think she's going to get in? Anjanou Ellis? This is our last episode before nominations come out, which is crazy.
Well, I'm a lock for nominations. So that's the least four people left.
And you can thank Frances Fisher for that, by the way.
I paid her $10 million.
Got to cut that. Yeah. Brett, you got to cut that.
No, I don't know. I think maybe it happened too late.
That's what we thought about Andrea Riseborough.
I guess it was kind of the same timeline, wasn't it?
I don't think it's too late. I think it's one interesting dynamic with this movie is there's a lot about Ava DuVernay and what she achieved with the movie, and is it targeted enough?
It kind of splits the vote because like people are like, oh, wait, is this campaign to nominate Anjanou Ellis?
Is my ballot just origin?
Is it a straight origin ticket like Julianne Moore's Super Mario Brothers? like, how does that work? I mean, because Ava, you know, famously was not nominated for Selma, which was crazy.
Yeah.
In its year so maybe the campaign is more for Ava DuVernay than it is for Anjanou Ellis,
but that sounds like a much steeper climb.
Yeah, those directors don't live here.
Yeah, those directors want to nominate a bunch of Europeans who you never see coming, which is what happens every year.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Very predictably, we've talked longer about the race than I thought we were going to, and I don't want to keep our guests waiting forever, so I'm going to pivot abruptly to talking about these shows.
Yeah.
How are the Emmys? How do we feel about... we want to talk about the Emmys. They just happened as we're recording this, and feel like as the project of award shows and our interest in them, like it is interesting to watch them even if the winners themselves are not relevant to Oscar season. And I was really interested in what they did with Anthony Anderson, and then also the nostalgia and the bits and the way they really lean into that for the Emmys. And I thought it really worked, and it's the kind of thing that I think the Oscars are terrified of.
Well, what works is that awards shows, and I don't mean this pejoratively at all, are corny. They're like glitzy long evenings where rich people celebrate themselves and we
and
watch
we
like
it.
Yes, like, you know, and like, but we all have entered into that social contract.
Yeah.
I don't like when the Emmys or the Oscars or whatever other show tries to be cool and be like, we're going to lower the stage, because, you know, the year that Will Smith slapped Chris Rock,
that
was a low stage. If there had been 8 more steps, like there normally
he
are,
he believes this
that
with every
never
fiber
would have
of his
happened.
Being.
It never would have happened if Will, because Will Smith on step 4 would have been like, "What am I doing?"
And you are right. You are right.
But it was only 2 steps, and so it was like
they were
so
we're having dinner right there.
Just, yeah, no, like no. We've all had 2-step decisions, and I think 4-step decisions are, you know, more reliable. But.
What are we talking about?
What I'm saying is, I think the tinkering with the award shows, like obviously the COVID era, like they had to figure out something. But in general, these producers are trying to like be cool and like, oh, we're going to make it feel like a club or whatever. Like, yeah. No one wants that shit. We just want standard, high stage, golden set, you know, setting, whatever, award shows.
Yep.
And I think the Emmys kind of did that. Yep. And they also were corny with the sets. You know, we're bringing about the like all of the old TV show sets and have the cast reunite. And like, we're celebrating TV. It was the Emmys was a show about shows. And I think that worked.
Yeah.
It was a real contrast, too, with how the Emmys often run on a particular network because they always alternate between the four broadcast networks. And they'll have, like, the stars of this strange Fox procedural that you've never heard of who were paired. And it's like, what is this? And they're presenting Best Actress. Yeah, and it's this doesn't quite have the weight that it probably should. But this year, they really did away with that. And it was like, every presenting team felt meaningful and interesting. Mm-hmm. Like bringing the cast of Martin together was so surprising and interesting. Yeah. And I think that those kinds of pairings contributed to Quinta Brunson being three times as emotional as she probably would have been a year ago.
And Carol Burnett being right there too.
The cast of Martin very pointedly being like, we never got this kind of awards attention.
Right.
And like, and kind of like shining a light on the Emmys not so great history was also instructive and good in a way.
My edit would maybe be that next year you bring the It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia cast out and have them do it rather than doing that bit twice in 1 year. But it was nice to see them there at least.
Right.
But it was a challenge show from the beginning. It was pushed so many months. Nobody's talking about TV right now. It feels like the movies are what's in the conversation. The ratings were really, really bad.
I missed that.
Yeah, they were really bad.
Were they opposite a football game or something?
Yeah, and apparently the Republican primary is off and running.
Oh, interesting.
Sure.
What are you talking about?
That started last night.
And
I think that when you have that against you, it maybe encourage them to think a little bit outside the box, to actually pay homage to what they were celebrating in a way that felt significant, that could maybe provide a blueprint for how they can move forward. As to your question as to whether the Oscars can follow something like that, they did try to do a few reunions a few years ago, and it was kind of confusing and overpraised. Yeah. I think that was the Will Smith year.
Don't look at me.
I don't know. I missed the.
We don't have Google in front of us.
I know. I missed the secret.
I missed the past winners giving the testimony to each nominee.
Oh my God, that was
those things went on for 8 minutes, and everyone hated them. And we were like, more, please.
Yeah, we were. It's like 1 a.m, and they're not haven't even gotten to costume design, and we're like, yes. But I just think the pomp and the circumstance is the whole point.
Yep.
You know, and I think that like the Oscars this year will be fine. Whatever. You know, we talk about hosts and it's like, well, like you watched John Mulaney do the Governor's Awards and he was so good. And it was like that kind of right mix of like highbrow humor, but also kind of silliness and celebrating movies, but making fun of the movies. Like that's a delicate balance to strike. And I thought that Anthony Anderson did that well with the shows. I thought that Chelsea Handler did that. Obviously, Joe Coy was amazing.
Well, no, this is a great point because Joe Coy has spent the last week basically saying Hollywood's a bunch of softies and but what's fascinating is immediately after that you had John Mulaney playing to almost the exact same audience at the Governor's Awards who and I was there, they were laughing hysterically, they had a great time. He's not like a nice comic who's just going to play nice with everybody. He's not the meanest guy in the world, but, you know, he's throwing some barbs. And then you had Chelsea Handler, who does her Chelsea Handler thing, and she can be a little raunchy and do her usual shtick, and it played really well.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can have an Anthony Anderson, who is not as typical of a comedian host, and he's a little bit more in with the performers, and he felt very present, which I appreciated because the host so often disappears after their opening monologue. And again, here was a model for how you can do this. And to have
to do jokes and also participate in bits like he did. Yeah.
So to have three different hosts, really distinctive appeals, senses of humor, all do a good job tells me that it is possible that maybe not everyone should be running away from this gig, which is the headline.
I just think with the Golden Globes as well, like we lived through this crazy year where Barbie was the biggest hit of the year, was the cultural phenomenon of like kind of a fucking half generation. Like it was a huge deal. And all of that finally in a televised award show, like let's have this comedian like distill all of that, all of the success and whatever. And it's
where are you going with this, Richard?
I'm going to the word boobies.
Like, that was Joe Coy, like, gathered all of the cultural information, was like, boobies. And it's like, I would be better at hosting that show than he was. Like, pay me the $500,000 or whatever.
Yeah.
No, he probably did not get paid that, but.
I mean, we know what we're getting with Jimmy Kimmel. He is hosting the
Oscars.
We're
getting paid $500,000 each to do this right now. But yeah.
Like, Jimmy Kimmel's not going to change what he does. I think he strikes a great tone. Like, I've always been a fan of that. But it's the structure around it, the building sets for the reunions, the Emmys, that I thought worked so well to kind of make you understand what you're looking at. It came at the expense of the acceptance speeches. And I was wondering, I don't actually know how you guys feel about it. I think Anthony Anderson's mom was great. I kind of enjoyed her presence in all of it.
She only did it twice-ish.
Yeah, and cuts off Jennifer Coolidge, who won last year. But the speeches were relentlessly short, but people didn't seem to mind. I mean, a lot of them had won the night before the Critics' Choice Awards, as we saw, David.
That is my answer.
But do we feel like maybe acceptance speeches should get shorter? It feels like sacrilege to say.
No, because I want the mechanism in place that like keeps the show running on time, but also for Melissa Leo to Melissa Leo is still giving her acceptance speech? It's been 10 years.
Well, Renee Zellweger is still naming people. Yeah. Just like as our laundry list, right?
Melissa Leo was standing in the Dolby. Yeah. No, you want to allow room for that kind of rambling, exciting moment. I mean, maybe only a few people think it's exciting, but the Emmys did feel a little bit like regimented, like in a way that it felt less loose and sort of exciting because everyone felt very on mission.
Yeah.
And you don't want the Oscars to be that.
Yeah.
It's a kind of... It's a balance, and honestly, I think it's a matter of feeling it out a little bit. Like with somebody like Cheryl Lee Ralph, an Emmys from the year before this one, that went on for a little while, and it was by far the best moment of the night when she sang her speech, and it was like breathtaking. It was amazing. I'd never seen anything like that on an awards show before. But I think having the standard of don't talk too long and being able to react in the moment, if someone's doing something a little bit more meaningful, maybe giving them the space to do it. I say that, and I know it's basically impossible to do that, and you have really awkward cutoffs, and it doesn't go well.
But Soderbergh started that precedent when he did the Oscars in 2021 at the train station in LA, where he was like, I'm producing the show, I'm directing the show. I have instructed all the winners to not thank individual names. No one wants to hear the name of your agent or whatever. Just share an anecdote, like say something personal. And the Emmys this year, on two or maybe more occasions, they had like Quinta Brunson when she won. There was a thing on the bottom of the screen that was like she would also like to thank.
They had quite
a few. That feels like an interesting thing to sort of implement, where it's like, okay, Kevin Huvane has been thanked enough. So is his brother.
Never enough.
So what if we just had like Anne Hathaway or whoever like winning an Oscar, just like speaking from the heart, not having to go through the list of like, and my lawyer and whatever, like... I don't know.
I mean, Quinta Brunson had that, but they also gave her time. Like, she was emotional. Yeah. They knew to lean into that. Like, it did seem like it worked. Like, Anthony Anderson's mom was not going to pull her off stage. But then when, like, Jennifer Coolidge is accepting for the second year in a row, she's like, okay, fine, I'll play into the bit and go. So they read the room well.
There has to be an intuitive producer who's, like, actually, like, engaged during the broadcast, who's like, cue the play-up music for this person and don't and hold it for this person.
Yeah.
You know? I think this team is very intuitive.
Have you ever watched the video of the control room when Cuba Gooding Jr. won? It's on YouTube. It's like from within the control room where the guy's like, cut to that camera, cut to that camera. And Cuba Gooding Jr. is like talking louder and louder. And in the control room, they're louder and louder. It's incredible. It's like watching ballet happening.
Because you could never play that off. Like that was amazing.
No, I think. And then he just kind of kept talking over it. It made it look like the hardest job in the world, honestly.
Well, let's try it next year. Let's put our hats in the ring.
I think we're going to take a quick pause, and Richard and Dave are going to go to the bar or wherever it is that you go, and we're going to welcome in our guest from Killers of the Flower Moon. So thank you for being here for Little Gold Men Live.
Thank you, guys. Bye.
Hi. So... Hi. So, we're welcoming Lily Gladstone, the star of Killers of the Flower Moon, Jacqueline West, the costume designer of Killers of the Flower Moon, and Julie O'Keefe, the Osage clothing consultant of Killers of the Flower Moon. Hi, you guys.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us here. How's everybody doing? You're at the final gasp of many, many conversations about this movie for now. How's everybody feeling?
Great. Just happy to be with these two.
Yeah. Well... Julie, when you have been giving interviews with Jacqueline before, you talked about how you were brought into this movie for, I think, 10 days to be a clothing consultant. But it seems like from the very beginning, you were like, 10 days? Like, I think this is going to be a much longer process. So how did that process work where you and Jacqueline began working together on this and build the partnership that you have now?
Well, you know, when you start getting into the different layers of the silhouettes that we have in our clothing, and those silhouettes have not changed for over 150 years. And so really sitting down, when you see how many multiple ways a man can wear a blanket and how many multiple ways a woman can wear a blanket or a shawl, and we have three different types just for that type of covering, then you have something like the wedding coat. And I just knew that it was going to be a situation where you're looking at particular research photos, of which Jackie had thousands. But within those photographs of these, you know, historic Osages, you're really looking at the subtleties of who they are and how they're representing themselves out into the world. And so if you have someone like a Chief Bonnycastle, he's going to be wearing this very long style blanket, but it tells you that he's a man of importance. You're looking at Molly. And so she is in this situation where you have Lizzie Q, and then you have Anna, and then you have Molly, then you have Rita and Minnie. And so you're watching a family where this world has been forced in on them. And so for Lizzie Q, because at that time, she and her husband both were raised on the prairie, and we lived off the land. The value of money was nothing to us because we traded and really hunted for everything, for all of our needs. And so you see the history of that trade through people that would come across our lands. And people are always talking about how it's a peace pipe, but that's what schools tell you. The reality is that we were our own border patrol. We had our own borders. We wanted to know the same things that we want today with the borders we have now. How long are you going to be here? Why are you coming across? What is your reason? And so a lot of that you see in the history of the clothing. So you've got Lizzie Q, who's traditional. And so she's coming in with these children. And they basically came in, the government did, and said, we will either cut your rations or you need to send your children to boarding schools. The boys would go to military schools. The girls would go to Catholic girls' schools, most of them, within Osage anyway. So what would happen is, you know, these girls have come back. And you see each one of these young women now representing themselves within a world that they're trying to fit into. They're trying to find their place and a safe place. So you have Anna, who's completely decided to go into the 1920s contemporary world. And so, you know, from the photographs that Jacqueline had, we could tell that that is where she had really put her place in this world. Then you look at Molly, who is identifying in her heart with Osage. This is who she is. And she understands this really in her being. So what's happening is she's coming out and she's representing herself in these Osage clothing, which is all traditional. Then you have the other two girls, Rita and Minnie. Rita and Minnie are committing to a contemporary style, but then what they're doing is bringing these blankets and these shawls in, and we wore those for modesty, and they wore them in different ways for different situations that would be going on, a funeral, a baby naming, and so they have certain things that they're wearing for these particular situations, and each one of those is going to be placed on them and folded differently for whatever they're doing. Molly goes to see Pitts Beattie. She's wearing a shawl. She walks in to talk business with him. Those shawls are basically covering us for modesty. And she's letting him know, I've come to do business with you. You have a delegation of Osages. They are all going, men and women, to Washington, D.C. to talk to President Coolidge. And so what's happening is you have this power suit that's really being worn, and they're walking en masse to let them know, and now I'm talking about the White House, we are here to do business with you. We are wearing our very best, and we're showing you who we are. And you can imagine 60 or 70 natives who you really aren't familiar and ever seeing brown skin that often. And they're walking en masse up to the White House. And I can't imagine what they must have thought at the White House when they saw them coming in. And so they're making a statement. And so we do those same things today when we go on our own visits to the White House. I've been to the White House 3 times in my ribbon work blanket. I used to live there. And it's one of those where I'm honoring the person that I'm with, but I'm also telling them, I'm here as an individual showing you who I am. And that's what we were portraying in the movie.
I think that's a pretty great sense of, you know, to, I could ask Jacqueline what Julia brought, but it seems like she just showed us what she brought in terms of knowledge. But I was really struck what you said before about how when you're building costumes for characters, you build them a closet, like what Molly would have had in her closet, and kind of, Jacqueline, what I think you said is that, you know, Lily, you'd be able to come and say, like, what would she wear in this instance? And for you guys, that's a lot of freedom for you to give to the actors, but also, Lily, I imagine as an actor, it helps you immensely with building who the character is, of having that selection put in front of you by someone like Jacqueline. How does that work?
Yeah, we would talk about it quite a bit. And then I remember at some point through the process, after Jackie and I had had these conversations, usually came down to the shoes. Because Jackie had these gorgeous shoes built that Molly would have had made custom with the money that she had. And, you know, the shoes that you wear in town when you're going to go meet with your guardian, you wear the closed toe heel, the European or American style shoe. And then also just tracking how Molly was feeling with her illness, with diabetes, and with her pregnancy, and, you know, when the mocks would go on. So a lot of times that's kind of what the conversation would come down to. Yeah, and then kind of discussing, all right, when are we stylizing a beautiful, what was that for Minnie's funeral? What was the, was it Ukrainian? Was it Hungarian?
The shawl.
The shawl. Hungarian shawl. It was Hungarian.
But it was also, there were a lot of conversations about how you would wear the shawl. And, and mainly, once, if you're working with a consummate actress like Lily, they really find the character very early on. And I've always said that costume was the bridge between the actor and the character. And once you really get to know that character, like I feel I got to know Lily, I got to know Molly through Lily and how she was becoming her, they dress themselves. You make a closet, like we were talking about, with all the possibilities that she would have had at her disposal in Osage Country, and what skirt she would have, what, just by who she was, that she was traditional, what her taste would be in blankets. And then it kind of just came together. The character dresses themselves.
One of my more fond memories is on our last scene, like our last scenes of shooting, Jackie had built a shirt for me, a ribbon shirt entirely out of silk, for me as my wrap gift with Molly stitched in, and I still have it. But me, I walk in my trailer and I see this beautiful shirt hanging up and then this other beautiful shirt hanging up. I'm like, oh, she's letting me choose. So I ended up choosing the shirt that Jackie built for me as my wrap gift, and I'm wearing it in one of the last scenes. And I think wardrobe is very much where I found the last elements of Molly. I mean, usually it is with any character that you play. And I remember the first fitting that I had with Julie. You were tying me into one of the broadcloth skirts with the butterfly pleat. And, you know, I feel like there's a perception a lot of people have of Native people, especially if you're like enthralled by us from kind of like a new agey perspective, that everything's loose and free. And it's just like, no, we're very protocoled people, very particular protocoled people, very proper, especially traditionalists. And I mean, I don't know how you guys wear 5 layers of wool broadcloth in the middle of the summer, but you do it. But I remember
gladly.
Yeah. Yeah. Eventually, you know, you sweat enough, you've got a natural cooling system, and then I would so much rather wear that much wool than that much polyester in the summer. I'll say that. But yeah, Julie tied me in after I was wrapped in the broadcloth skirt, which is a blanket folded a number of ways, and then you're tied into it. And I was kind of just slumped and then suddenly my spine was straight. The way you have to hold your shoulders to hold the blanket is almost in like first position, like ballet first position. And I think I said to you, like, oh, I get how this nation birthed America's first prima ballerina. Maria Tallchief from Fairfax, Oklahoma, was Osage. She was married to George Balanchine, co-founded the New York City Ballet. She was America's first prima ballerina at Ballet Russe.
Know that fizzy feeling you get when you read something really good, watch the movie everyone's been talking about, or catch the show the internet can't get over? At the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we chase that feeling 5 times a week. We talk about the buzziest movies, TV, music, books, and more. From lowbrow to highbrow to in between, catch the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Well, we have a clip from the movie that we can share that shows off from the wedding scene, which is, you know, some of the most stunning looks in the entire film. So we can let everybody look at that, and then I'll ask you guys about it.
Molly. Ernest. I don't know what that bitch say on cold. They will lose me.
I've known Molly and her sister since they were little girls running around,
making a lot of trouble.
We ate one more much.
Echo. Molly's dear departed father, Nikaise Y, was a dear, dear friend of mine, a beloved friend of the heart. He always used to tell the white men just to call him Jimmy, but I always called him by his proper name. Nakaise Wai. We had great respect for each other.
So, Julie, before we got started, we were talking about that coat, which I think is the absolute showstopper in that entire scene, and how those wedding coats still have a really prominent life and prominent role in Osage life today. But the origin of them, I think, is fascinating because I think, Jackie, you said it felt like you found Marie Antoinette in a horse opera all of a sudden. It's just like, you know, such a beautiful, striking image. But, Julie, can you talk about why, for this period, for Molly and Ernest's wedding, why that wedding coat would be part of the ceremony?
Well, the history of the wedding coat is actually dates all the way back to a delegation of Osages that went to see Thomas Jefferson. And they went in. It was a U.S. was a new country, and so they were showing their power and might. And so this delegation goes in, and as we're, you know, sitting down and of course, with a translator, and they're talking, and basically Thomas Jefferson is really showing them what they have, and they're discussing business, the chief looks over and he sees this military coat on this general that's standing next to him, to Thomas Jefferson. And he really admires it. And so when they get ready to leave, Thomas Jefferson looks at that general and says, take that coat off and give it to him. So the man takes the coat off and he gives it over as really like a diplomatic gift to this chief. So what happens is our Osage men, especially in history, even Thomas Jefferson writes about it, but there were these big, statuesque, strapping men, and there was no way that they were going to fit into this European size military coat. And so they took it home and they gave it to their daughters. And so I love the way that Jackie says this best, but she always says that there's this rebellious nature about it, because they took something that was to show power and might over us. And these women and their families, when these girls would get married, would take that and we would put ourselves in that. We would put our own ribbons and our own ribbon work and buttons and different things that people had, and families would gather together. And these were all to be given away as gifts to people who had helped you with your wedding. And these would be arranged marriages. These were, you did not marry who you loved then. You were, these were arranged for you. And so when they came to underneath the arbor for this wedding, you would have this woman coming in, and the man that was marrying her knew that he was marrying someone of great prominence because they clearly had a chief or a councilman in their family, and that had been given to them as a gift. And so that's the history of basically why they wore those wedding coats. And as it passed down in tradition, and a lot of those meetings dissipated, families then got together, as they do today. We still use those coats, but not for weddings. It's for something called passing of the drum. But for Molly, they get together, the whole family, and starts putting together these wedding coats. And a lot of times you'll see 7 to 8 and what we refer to as bridesmaids, but that's not how we looked at it culturally. And so you have these different gifts that you're going to be giving to these different people. And all of these are going to be given away, including to some of the girls that may be in the wedding and their family was instrumental in helping you put this wedding on.
So Jackie, as a costume designer, when you get, you know, you have this historical detail, you have a scene this large with this many people, what kind of gift is it to have something that beautiful and ornate to work with for a scene like this?
Well, it was a gift. And what I learned early on when I started my research on the Osage, one of the first things I found was this wedding coat, and I'd never seen anything like it. But as I started digging deeper, I realized so much of the Osage clothing and what they wore was so unique from other Plains nations that I portrayed in other movies through wardrobe. And the wedding coat, I'd never seen anything like it. And that's when I started researching it. And at first, when I first saw it, I thought, oh, I can't do that. How am I going to show that to Marty? It's so over the top. You know, I've never seen any kind of Native person in that. Then when I learned the history and the beauty of it, I got sold on it. And when I showed him, he loved it. And, you know, it becomes a whole scene in the movie, but it's the history that I think behind it that's so brilliant, and how so many of the trade items got incorporated into it, French ribbon and German silver, braid, buttons, the beadwork, and then incorporated into that coat are all the other accessories, like the finger-woven belt, the ribbon work, all the woodland embroidery, and everyone was different. So for me, it was the most, probably the most fun I had on the movie, creating those coats with, I have a brilliant cutter fitter that I've done a lot of movies with, Rosalie Lee. She came down from Canada. Leo helped me get her in because she'd done all his clothes on The Revenant. And she's just so brilliant. And she had a brilliant workroom, and she made every single coat very, very different and unique to each sister, each bridesmaid. And then Julie helped so incredibly with, that's when the 10-day thing was not going to work. And I said, 10 days, I need her through the whole movie. She got every great artisan.
You told me that on day 9.
Yeah. Yeah. Every incredible artisan involved in this project that you saw up there. And she calls it kitchen art, but it's these women who traditionally, it's traditions passed down from mothers and aunts down to their daughters and their granddaughters. And, they did all the bead work, all the ribbon work, and it made them part of telling of this seminal story for the Osage. They could all get involved and be part of it. And when they saw it in the theater, I hope they are always going to be proud that they worked on it.
Marty was really drawn to the whole wedding as well. My wrap gift from him was a hand-painted rendering or model of a Sicilian horse cart. Because if you look it up, just Google it.
You have a lot of great rap gifts. This is jealous.
Apparently, it was in the background of Mean Streets. I've watched the movie again to look for it, and I can't find it. But it was somewhere dressed in Mean Streets. But it's this beautiful wood carved horse pulling this cart that would be used for weddings, for different ceremonial things in Sicily, and the horses would have these really large ornate plumes on the top of their head that looked actually a lot like the wedding hats. Bright colors. And Marty said it had special significance to him because he said had he been a boy born in Sicily, he would have grown up being one of the painters of those carts, because there were the stories, the pictures painted on these Sicilian carts were kind of the way that you would have been a filmmaker back in old Sicily before cameras.
Wow.
So it was, that was a really sweet gift to get. And, you know, when I saw it and went and wrapped it and looked at it, it's like, wow, just immediately it reminded me of the wedding scene. And Marty said that's why he chose it. He chose to give me that because of how much he felt, like how much he felt of his own culture.
Yeah.
Reminiscent of what he was seeing with Osage as well. Two very story-based and, like, proper but, you know, expressive and bright and beautiful and just rich cultures.
Yeah.
So that was cool.
There were so many people involved as actors and characters in this film whose relatives had been part of the Reign of Terror. And that was really the beauty of it. One of the scenes that gave me chills is one Julie mentioned. We reproduced from a panoramic photo. I made 22 sections, sent those to Pendleton in Oregon, and they reproduced every blanket from that original panoramic shot of the Osage Nation traveling to Washington, D.C. to do something about the murders during the Reign of Terror. And when we shot that at the railroad station that Jack built in Pawhuska, I got chills because so many people there came up to me and said, you know, my grandfather was part of that group, or my great aunt was part of the group. And they all got to be in it and be part of it. And it just, that scene really brought tears to my eyes when I realized how many people were involved in this story that got to be in this movie. And in the roundhouse scene also, Julie,
there were a lot of people that in that roundhouse scene that had members of their family that were on council at that time. So there were several people that were in that, including like the Shackelford brothers and just different people within the community. And the one thing, yes, and the Red Corns. Well, there's one thing I really, in the scene that we saw with the man that was marrying Molly in Ernest as a gentleman named Tolly Redcorn. And I was driving around in my car on a Saturday, and I used to go through all of the transfer pictures to look through everything on Sundays. And I get this text over my little screen, and it's from the producer, Marianne Bauer, who did a lot of really fabulous research on this from Marty's team, and also Jacqueline. And it said, "We have a new character in a new scene. What would a leader wear?" And so I came back to them and said, "Have you ever visited the Immaculate Conception Church in Pawhuska?" And because it was COVID, no one had gone. Well, when I was growing up and I was a brownie, I would go to the Catholic churches where they would hold our little meetings. But the windows that are in there, Osage just put a lot of money into that church. And so they have these magnificent German stained glass windows. And there's a whole story about that on its own, where they had to be buried in World War I under the Danube River when things were being bombed, and then brought them back out and then shipped them to Oklahoma. But they're spectacular. But there's one window that they have that's the only window in the world that has actual indigenous people in it that are the same likeness, because there's always faces of angels and different people within all of the stained glass that you see, but they're never actual likenesses of people. Well, they went to get the Pope's dispensation exactly at the same time that the story was taking place. So in that window is the actual likeness of Chief Bonnycastle. There is a Chief Baconrind that's in there, and there are their wives and several of these people and council members that would have been there at the time that this story took place, and they're in that window. So I took a screenshot off my phone and sent it over and said, this is Chief Baconrind. And I think it would be a good idea if your workroom created this exact image in this silk green shirt. He has mascal beans. He was part of Native American church also. You can see it in the pectoral cross that he has on. He's a leader. You can tell it in the otter cap with the medallion that you see. He's holding a eagle wing fan, and he's blessing Molly and Ernest with that fan, which is used in our ceremonies. Everything about him was replicated. And when I saw it for the first time, it was so moving, because as a child, I loved staring at that. When I would finish with my projects, I would ask to go into the church and sit and look at it because it was so beautiful. And I saw it come to life on the screen. And it just, to me, the whole scene is spectacular.
Well, Julie and Jackie and Lily, thank you guys so much for joining us here. Thank you all for being here and making this first ever live Little Gold Men possible. Thank you to Apple and everybody else. And we'll see you guys outside.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.